right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Inside Writing. This show is presented by Gotham Writers Workshop, offering writing classes of all types and sizes. You can visit us at gothamwriters.com. A reminder that if you've missed any episode of Inside Writing, you can find the recorded version on YouTube or wherever you listen to podcasts. The same goes for this show. It'll be available either later today or tomorrow on all of those platforms as well. Moving into the show for today, as you all know, there is that Q&A button down there on the Zoom dashboard. Submit your questions for the panelists as soon as you have them. The more questions we have, the sooner I will cut to Q&A. So make sure you get your questions in early. And today, we're going to be talking about short genre fiction part two. So we did short genre fiction part one on December 10th. But since genre is such a big area of discussion, we dedicated two episodes to it. The first episode skewed a little bit towards science fiction. This one will skew a little bit towards fantasy. But again, we're going to be touching on all genres, same as last time. Enough announcements. We're going to start, as we always do, with a quote, a short quote, one of my favorite quotes, actually, from Lloyd Alexander, who said, "Fantasy is hardly an escape from reality. It's a way of understanding it." We're going to talk more about that later. But now let's meet our panelists. Our first panelist, author of the books Spark and the League of Ursus, Leepai Yahoo, and the War with No Name series, as well as short pieces appearing in Grotesque Quarterly, Literary Review, and Juked, Robert Rapino. Hello, Robert.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks for being here. Our second panelist, CEO and founder of the Brink Literacy Project, as well as founder and editor-in-chief of Friction Literary Magazine, Danny Headland. Hello, Danny. Thank you for being here.
So, thanks for having me.
Thank you. So we're going to start with some points of clarity, as we always do. Robert, I want to start with you. In fantasy and science fiction, what do you see as some of the big differences between these two big genres of fantasy and science fiction?
Yeah, so I admit I'm paraphrasing Rod Serling here. Well, that's not a bad admission to make, but I think the way he phrases it is, science fiction is the improbable made plausible, and fantasy is the impossible made plausible or probable or something like that. So I think the difference I work with is that science fiction is still dealing with something that could at least be theoretically possible in the world as we understand it, whereas fantasy might involve more supernatural elements or magic or just things that completely defy laws of physics or science or anything like that. So I think that's the big difference you're working with. That's the way I usually tell my students.
Gotcha. And Danny, when it comes to writing fantasy, there are different tiers of fantasy, low fantasy, high fantasy. What's the difference between the two?
Right. This is probably a really lame way to describe it, but mostly it just comes down to world building. High fantasy, usually you're working in an entirely different world. So you're doing a great deal of building out everything from like geopolitics to like what kind of magical plant is this? And then low fantasy is usually grounded in some way in our reality. So a reader can come in understanding like, oh, it's set in New York, but all the buildings are magicians. So in word count on the publishing side, high fantasy agents usually will take a lot more word count because you've got a lot more to talk about in a way where low fantasy tends to be a little bit more condensed. Mm-hmm.
And Robert, in terms of your own writing, what genres do you cover? Do you favor some more than others?
I think I'm mostly writing in fantasy with some sciencey elements where I can at least articulate them, although I have cheated a lot. But I think I'm writing fantasy elements in the real world, in the so-called real world. And usually the characters are characters from our world who are dealing with something improbable or, you know, just strange. I have never constructed a world in the way that Danny has just described. I haven't attempted that yet. But usually the fiction I'm working on is something, not just something improbable, but also often something absurd happening. And then characters with some checkered past or some personal issue trying to deal with this. And I should mention, just to piggyback off what Danny said, the Science Fiction Writers Association website has a gigantic checklist for building a world. It goes into everything, the geopolitics, the what they eat, what it smells like after it rains, you know, that kind of stuff. So if you're looking for more detail, it goes on for pages and pages. It's incredible. But all right.
Thank you, Robert. And for listeners, I will include a link to that in the show notes. Any links they mentioned during the show, I will include those after the show. Danny, riffing off of what Robert said, in terms of both your writing and what Friction is looking for, what genres do you skew towards?
All right. Much like Robert, I really like the reader to feel a little bit more grounded. So usually as a publisher and as a writer, I like things where you kind of recognize what's happening and then really weird elements start seeping in through the borders. So whether or not that's fun horror or it's a little magical realism or, you know, just flat out sci-fi, I really enjoy that. It seems to be as a publisher, we get a lot of the same submissions and all publishers have this. So it's like, here's an angsty feeling I have about a divorce I'm going through, or like, here's another New York college professor banging their student, or for strange, like a whole bunch of stuff about like degenerative mental diseases and not being able to conceive. This tends to be across the board. Every literary journal and publishing house gets a lot of this stuff. So I don't want to say those stories aren't valuable, but you have to really be interesting to talk about that. So if you can weave a genre element in to tell me something really interesting about something that's on our minds all the time, like that makes me super happy as an editor. With my own writing, I have a degree in quantum mechanics, so I'm just like an uber geek. So I'm always into things that kind of bleed in things that we find interesting in the scientific community and make them a little bit magical. I find writing about that stuff really cool. Like I've been rewatching the His Dark Materials series and it's reminding me of reading it when I was 11 and being like, oh, remember when the world was magic and interesting. That's what I really care about as a reader and a writer and an editor. So that's what I try to hunt. Mm-hmm.
Robert, genre fiction, particularly when it comes to science fiction and fantasy, it feels pretty boundless. Like you can create whatever you want. Do you feel that way? Do you set boundaries for yourself, or is it really just you can do whatever you want with genre fiction?
I like to say you could do whatever you want. And then of course, you know, several thousand words into a story, I'm like, wait, this actually doesn't work. So yeah, I think it's a good starting place to say, you know, you're limitless. I think as it goes on, you will always benefit from doing research. And even in my case, you know, I'm not an expert in science, and some of the research I've done to set these boundaries, very often what I'm doing is saying like, okay, that's, well, just to give one example, I've written about ant colonies, for example. And I did enough research on them to figure out what was actually real and what I could just, what little kernels I could take. Like just one example within that would be the, how an ant queen works. An ant queen is not really a queen in any sense of the word. She's not a ruler. She just is a specialized worker. But I couldn't resist making her more of a ruler because that just made her a more interesting character. So I took some elements from the way ant colonies actually work and used them, but ultimately made her more of a classical kind of ruler. So some of the research I was doing was to help set some boundaries, just to make the world make a little more sense. But yeah, I mean, if you're working on a first draft, you know, just have fun. Please have fun, writers out there. You know, it's a tough world. Try to have a little fun with it, you know.
Danny, what about you? How do writers create in a seemingly boundless creative sphere in genre fiction?
Honestly, everyone just has their own kind of style. Like a lot of my authors are heavy researchers. Like they will just, you know, either like travel to esoteric places in, you know, Shanghai to really feel what it's going to feel like. Most of us don't have a disposable budget to randomly just fly over Shanghai to like feel what the dirt feels like on our fingers. So some people just, you know, live at the library. Other people, I'm one of them. I tend to, if I break flow, I just ruin it. So I'll just write blank really large when I'm writing, like, and then they encountered blank. And then I write a note like research, actually, how the Scottish government worked before the referendum. And then I'll go back and kind of pop that in. But I think you just got to have a feel for it. A lot of people that write historical fiction have told me, like, it was really hard to move from something that was confined by how history moved into an open genre because they're like, oh God, I could do anything. I have no markers. So I think there's kind of gives and takes on both sides. Like Robert said, just have as much fun with it as possible and figure out what keeps you in the flow and what doesn't.
Yeah. And I would also add, you know, if you find yourself getting so bogged down with how the world works, you might have to just take a step back and ask yourself what's really important in the story. And to me, like, grounding it in the character and what they want and what stands in their way, what's holding them back, Like that can help clarify what's really important in terms of how much world building you have to do and how much exposition you have to do. So that can, that it always helps to focus back on the characters again.
Yeah, to piggyback off of what Robert said, I'm going to butcher this really badly, but someone somewhere said something about how to make video games. And they were like, what you need to break it down to is like, is the core of the game fun? So looking at something like Mario, it's like, do people enjoy jumping over things and then not dying if they jump right? And essentially, people decided, yes, they like that. So as an editor, when I look at a story, I'm always like, do I like the core of the story without any of the faff? Like, do I want to watch someone overcome a big challenge? Do I want to see someone do something magical? And if I can break it down into the one sentence synopsis and that makes sense, then I have a good core. But if everything out here is distracting the core of like, do I want to play something where I jump over a hole? The story has a broken bit and you should go back and give it some love.
Thank you. Thank you both. Robert and Danny, I'm going to ask you the same question because it sounds like you both kind of write with one foot in reality. So Robert, when you're writing that way, what's the process like whenever, you know, you're writing a story that's based in reality, but what happens in this reality is somewhat unreal, for lack of a better word? Do you approach it the same way?
I think I do. Yeah. Because a lot of people will obsess over the differences between so-called literary fiction and so-called genre fiction. But I do think the basic principle of having a character who wants something and is going to push the story forward, I mean, that principle applies no matter what, I think. Even if what they want is some magical thing that you haven't defined yet, if you're writing in that blank space, as they described, that rule still applies. And I think that sometimes people do get bogged down in worrying about how they can articulate what is actually real in this world and how they can build it. But often I keep it focused on that character and what could be holding them back, what they have to overcome, how they're going to change as a result of all this, Because I just did a talk with some middle schoolers where they asked like, well, how seems like all these premises have been done, all these, zombie apocalypses and alien invasions that they've all been done. How can we make something original? I'm like, you make it original with the unique character. And now I've made the mistake of making the character just a composite of me. I've gone through that phase. A lot of writers sometimes don't admit it, but I've done it too many times. I'm getting better at it. So,
thank you. And Danny, same question to you. You write with one foot in reality as well. What are some of the challenges that come into creating something so unreal out of reality?
Often I think the two things just want to fight with each other. I often struggle as a writer. I very rarely see this in other writers. This makes me think that I'm like stupid in a really unique way. Where I can't quite decide where the conflict should come from. So I always feel like to be a very intimate character-driven writer, a lot of the conflict should come from reality. So hypothetical, let's say I have a character who can control people's dreams. And I, obviously the conflict should be like, oh, there's a big dream conspiracy. But in my head, I'm like, oh goodness, like what if she doesn't get the promotion at that job? And like, what if that boy doesn't like her? And so there's this weird thing where I'm like, if you write genre, readers expect big genre conflicts. And I'm always like, oh, okay, but how do I keep it intimate and human? And I don't see that in any of our submissions. Like usually my writers are really, really good about being like, it makes really good sense that this exploded satellite also has everything to do with this woman's marriage. So I feel like if you can balance those things out, you're doing great. I'm not a good example because I'm a total asshat about it.
Can I also say, like, also when you're talking about the internal monologue of one of these characters, trying to create a world in which they're not constantly thinking about how fanciful the world is a huge challenge. Because if somebody was writing if someone from 100 years ago was writing about 2020, they would probably have a story in which a person is constantly thinking like, my phone is this incredible device that can reach satellites and can do blah, blah, blah. It's like, that's not the world we live in. We barely even think about how our phone works. It's just part of our lives. How can you incorporate that in a natural way that both explains to the reader what's going on, but without making it look like your narrator just happens to be thinking about the very thing that the reader needs to know? It's really difficult to do that, but it, you know, you just have to keep massaging it, you know, take out the clunky exposition. Okay. A person picks up a phone, they're not automatically thinking like, a few years ago, phones were invented, and that's why they work like that, because that's the temptation. You know.
You always hear the opposite of that as well, like especially in Portal fiction, where it's like, person comes from New York City and Zen is a magical world, but then apparently just accepts all of it. Just like, oh, yeah, centaurs. I'm cool with that. So it's such a fine balance to be like, how much would you actually react to this, and how much where the reader will allow you to explain how surprised you are. Mm-hmm.
So that, and you both mentioned this already, so I want to segue into talking about magic and how magic exists in fiction. Danny, I want to start with you, especially, you know, we hear a lot about magic systems and how each story has its own magic system and how, and the work writers have to do to sort of create this magic and what the rules of it is. How do writers go about creating, you know, unique experiences with magic when so much has been done already?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I just recently chatted with Emily Duncan, who wrote the Wicked Saints series. She's a really young writer. Her series started as a D&D campaign, just brilliant, lovely human. And for her, it was, when she was writing the campaign, it was so much about like how to create like darkness in a genre that doesn't typically have it. So she invented just like some really messed up blood magic that just seeps so much and has such a great give and take. And each book, the world building gets bigger. So there's bigger gods and bigger drama and bigger pain. And I'm always really interested in how we think about what we grew up with the magic. Like, we all read Tolkien. We're all like, okay, he invented everything. Let's just change it. And so I think if people are creating a new magic system, it's really interesting to try to look at how other genres are doing something. It's like Emily merged horror with fantasy. So if we're looking at how systems are made in the technological way and then merge them with magic, like talking about His Dark Materials, like Pullman was cool. String theory is barely a concept. I think magic is cool. Let's put them together. So I really like that. I think if we're going to talk about the change in genre is just crossing those lines and merging them and taking the best out of all those worlds. And then hopefully trying to make it as like cohesive as possible, which seems to be the second biggest problem to coming up with a unique idea, is making it execute in a way that doesn't make everyone angry.
Robert, what about you? What's your experience been with creating unique magic, or is that something you've dealt with?
I've dealt with it a little bit, but I think one thing to focus on would be the consequences, both macro consequences, huge, big consequences, and also just the mundane consequences. You know, you take, like, for example, the X-Men universe, where people have these powers that can do all sorts of incredible things. In some cases, they don't really do much incredible thing. But, you know, a world like that wouldn't automatically turn into World War III, or where, like, the government is just rounding up all the mutants and putting them in a concentration camp. Like, that could happen, but you also have to have the smaller moments. Like, I know in one of the X-Men movies, Iceman pulls a warm beer out of a case and blows on it, and it's ice cold now. And I'm like, yeah, there need to be moments like that woven in there as well, just to show, you know, like that this kind of magic has all sorts of consequences all over the world and in everybody's lives. And I think focusing on both of those can really help and just fill out your world, you know?
Yeah. And speaking of world, I want to talk a little bit more about world building here, because it is such a big part of science fiction, fantasy, all the genres out there. But Robert, when it comes to world building, especially in the confines of a short story, how do you approach what details are important to the story and what can be left out? Because for a novel, you have all the space in the world to build out a world, but in a short story, you don't. So what's your process there?
You know, there's a principle that Charlie Jane Anders, Danny already mentioned, she's written a lot about world building. And there's a line that she uses, and it's something like, you know, good world building shows what the characters see, but great world building shows what the characters don't see but should see. So if you can come up with a way of conveying, I mean, this is something I try to do. I'm not saying I'm always successful. I'm really good at talking about it in theory. In practice, it's a different thing. But you know, if you can come up with a way of conveying what the characters are missing, at least early in the book, and now maybe later on they have a revelation, and hopefully that revelation comes from them discovering what's up with this world rather than simply sitting there and being told. That's another temptation that's hard to resist. But I think if you could focus on it like that, that's what I tend to do or what I strive for. I'll leave it at that.
And does that, real quick follow, does your approach differ from short story to novel when it comes to world building?
I guess it doesn't really, because I think the same, it's just in a short story, you have to do it more quickly. And I think the short story format really forces you to start in the middle of things. Mm-hmm. So you can't get away with exposition at the beginning. You really have to start in the middle of things. And it requires a little more discipline, that's for sure. I think in a novel, you will be tempted to meander a bit. You will, and I know in my novels, like I've had entire chapters that are just like, this is the story of so-and-so. This is the backstory of this character, so you understand why he acts like this. I telegraph that to my readers sometimes. It needs to be done. Can't get away with that in a short story, I don't think. Unless you're only doing like three sentences of it, and then you gotta get moving. So it's just everything, all the same principles, but compacted to like the tiniest version of it to keep things going.
And Danny, when it comes to submissions that you're looking at for Friction, and both in your own writing as well, what are you looking for in world building? What makes the world really pop?
Yeah, world building is one of the most difficult aspects of writing genre on the short story side, just because it's space-wise. This is something that is probably the most common thing that we work on with authors. Friction is a really unique sort of publication, since we're owned by this like big bleeding heart nonprofit, that we give free edits to anything we see has potential. So we will take like a B-level story and then we'll work on it for like 6 months. So the really big thing with world building on the editorial side is usually for an author to dump world building at us incoherently in emails. Like, where did this monster come from? What is it eating? How long has it been around? Did a shaman summon it? And maybe 10% of that actually goes into the story. So we kind of get all of our heads together and we think, okay, what part of this world building is essential for the reader understanding the stakes for the characters, caring about the character, and what can we leave that's pretty ambiguous that kind of builds that bit of like Lovecraftian suspense? So that's kind of how we approach world building. It's always a delicate balance because my writers are stupidly talented and they ramble at me things that are so interesting, but I'm like, no, listen, like if I want to nominate this for the Hugo, I need it under like 6,500 words. So we're going to have to cut like 80% of the story. So it's always a fine balance of, do I really care about the characters? Do I understand enough about the world? I understand what's going on and I'm a little enchanted and that's about it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I should throw in there, I just came across a beautiful essay, and I will have to send the link to you. But it's about world building and exposition, and it uses as a case study the opening paragraph or the opening chapter of Octavia Butler's Wild Seed, I think. And if you look at the structure of it, it's actually really beautiful because it starts with an opening line that gets your attention. Then there's maybe like four sentences that just give a little bit of background. Then we're back to the person who's describing the opening line. They're doing some action. Then there's a shorter paragraph with a little bit more exposition. Then there's more action. Then there's maybe like one sentence of exposition. And then we keep, so you see like they give you just, she gives you just enough to get moving while blending it in with the rest of the story and just giving you what you need to know to get to the next sentence. Like having that discipline is really, it's a big part of getting better. So.
And Danny, is world building a selling point? Is it something that comes front and center to a story, or is it always the character or the plot that sells it first? Can world building be something that's like a focal point of a story?
I think the focal point for me as a publisher always comes down to character. We talk endlessly in editorial meetings about turning points. Like, I want to see change in characters. I want to care about them. Even if the change is, oh, wow, you made all the worst choices. You did nothing right, and now it's going terribly. Like, that's really, I want stories that kind of change the way we think about the world. And world building often has to take a backseat to that, because as readers, to be changed by something, we need to empathize. So we need to kind of put ourselves in the position of the human in the story and then kind of agree or disagree with what they're doing. So just plain world building kind of lacks, for me as an editor, that emotional pull that makes us affected by literature. There are some publishers that don't feel that way. Both on the literary fiction and genre side, like vignette fiction is really popular. I hate it. I just hate everything about it. I don't publish it. It makes my editors just so angry with me. But for me, I really need to see stakes and change. So world building isn't a human and can't go through huge emotional changes. So yeah, it kind of simmers in the background for me. Mm-hmm.
Robert, is it similar for you as a writing perspective? Are you always focused on character first, or do you ever start a story with a world?
I have started a story with a world, and I usually end up somewhat regretting it because I really think you should start with the character. Some of these writers who really are brilliant and then come up with idea-driven stories that are just a description of a world. I like Danny, I don't think I'm that crazy about those stories. When they're done well, I admire it, but I don't see myself trying that anytime soon. I just don't know if I could pull it off myself, because I think at some point I would have to throw in like a car chase or like a flashback to some gritty experience that explains why the character is the way they are. I just don't think I'd be able to resist that. But when some people can do it well, it does happen. And it is, I'm like, wow, that's just, their brain is just working in a completely different way from me.
So moving on from world building, I want to talk about the theme of a story, or the meaning, or the emotional truth. There's so many different words for it. But Danny, I want to ask you, how important, especially in genre fiction, is it for you to see a deeper meaning in a story other than it just being an interesting story?
I would say as a publisher, it's really important to me. If I ran a different sort of publication, it might be less so, but Friction is called Friction because it's supposed to challenge conventions. It's supposed to make you think differently about things. Few things make me happier than when readers send me hate mail. I'm like, I've done a great job as a publisher because this person is pissed off. And that requires that a writer really delves into something that maybe we don't want to look at or we don't want to think about, and then really unearths uncomfortable feelings about it. So theme is really important for that. But when I teach writing, I never recommend anyone start with theme. Like, it's something that I think should come really organically. Like, start with character, start with an interesting situation, and see how that character can change through it. And the rest of the stuff usually will fall into place. Certainly, as a writer myself, if ever I try to say something like big and interesting about philosophy, it's the worst stuff I've ever written. So I know that's kind of a hard thing for readers to be like, achieve this, but don't try it. But honestly, it will just happen if you're really writing something that you're passionate about and you're thinking really hard about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that 100%.
All right. Yeah, I had a follow-up for you. I was going to see if one question we often get is if you are a writer and you write the story and you don't see a deeper meaning, Robert, what's your process there? Do you sort of just set the story aside? Do you just dig deeper? What do you do? Or have you ever come across that?
It's happened. And look, I've sent out stories simply because I thought they were entertaining. I like to think that there's, you know, different readers might get different things out of them. But I've definitely just sent out stories that I just thought were fun, that had a character that you just want to hang out with, or some situation that really either, you know, provokes a reaction or whatever. It's something I can live with. And very often people have come up to me later and said, like, I really love the theme of such and such in your story. And I'm like, yeah, because I did that on purpose. You know, I agree though with Danny, like, I'm not saying you can't start with theme. And some people have said, like, I have started with theme and I pulled it off. I don't know how it happened. Maybe it was an accident. I respect that. But I think, yeah, theme will eventually, can eventually come out of these other things we're talking about, like building a coherent world and going with a character that we actually care about. I actually, this has nothing to do with genre, but I remember I was teaching a class when the movie Call Me By Your Name came out, and that movie ends with a character basically giving a speech that's about the theme of the movie. And I came in and I asked who had seen it. A few people raised their hands. I said, yeah, that thing that he does, don't do that yet. I don't know if you're ready to do that. I'm not even sure if I'm ready to do that. It's very difficult to pull off having a character tell the reader what the story was all about. It's, you have to really work hard to earn that, you know. So,
and Danny, is it a red flag if a story doesn't have a deep, if you read a story and you can't pull out a deeper meaning from it, is that a red flag for you, or is it something you'll work with the writer on, or how do you see it?
Oftentimes if we really like the story, but it doesn't have a punch, doesn't have an emotional punch, we will work with the author on that. And oftentimes the author thinks it's there and it's just not. So it'll just be a conversation about like, what do you think this story means? And then they'll tell me and I'll be like, oh, well, you didn't do that, but let's find out how to incorporate it. There are a few times, I'm a really big fan of absurdism, and I really like humor. And I have maybe published in my 6 year as EIC 4 funny things, and I love them. And they don't usually have big meanings. I'm specifically thinking we published this flash fiction about the letter Q calling up his literary agent. I mean, his booking agent being like, you know, it's bullshit that I don't get more things. Why do I always have to collaborate with you? Like, why didn't I get Cucumber? Like, you're a terrible literary agent. And I guess we could be like, well, this is an interesting commentary on the entertainment business. But it was mostly just, oh, wow, this is making me giggle into like my coffee. I need to publish it. So if something just, I feel like, brings me and my editors an extraordinarily weird amount of joy, but it's not going to, say, change all of my opinions and I'm going to vote down another political party, I will take chances on really well-done stuff that way. It's just really rare to even get that submitted or pitched up to my seniors.
Mm-hmm. Robert, simple question, but where do you get ideas from? Like, when you need inspiration to write another story, where do you go to find them?
I record my dreams, for one thing. So my War With No Name series is based not entirely, but it got its start as a dream. Although in that case, I had the basic idea of a war between humans and animals from the dream. But it wasn't until I actually came up with a good villain that I was like, oh, wait, this could actually work. Because at that moment, I only had a premise. I didn't have the good characters to combat each other. You know, I also just think, and hopefully we can do this more soon, but just, you know, going out and meeting people and learning about them and trying to see what they're all about. I mean, that will always help you come up with ideas, or at least come up with people to populate old ideas. You know, living in New York is a great, you know, way to do that, but there are plenty of other ways. And, you know, just listen to people and listen to what their background's all about. I mean, you know, there are entire universes inside of just, you know, some people's anecdotes, you know?
Danny, what about you? Where are some places writers can find inspiration, especially when it comes to writing stories about the unreal?
I think it's twofold. I mean, everyone will tell you read a bunch, read constantly, read until people think that you lack social skills and you're not watching enough television. I find it really helpful to like learn about other sort of fields. So like usually if an author comes to me, especially a really young one, is like, hey, what should I study at uni? I'm like, well, don't study English. Like, what do you want to write about? Like, go get a degree in archaeology. Go get a psych degree. Any of those things. So you have a really unique perspective. Because you can learn how to write from just writing and reading a bunch. So certainly, like, I randomly went to the museum the other day and just, like, found an esoteric sort of weird artifact in, like, the crumbling, like, Mayan section of the thing. And I was like, oh, God, I'd be so interested in this. So just trying to spark your brain as much as possible. That's for world building. On the writerly side, like, just go out and live. Like, that's why young writers tend not to get published, not because they're not talented, but because they haven't lived enough to figure out what are the things we should write about. So if you're a young writer, like, go make some great mistakes. Like, go have a really terrible love affair that hopefully ends with your life not being over. And then you can really kind of know enough about the human experience to write about it. And young people can do that if they just take big chances and live some good, weird events. Mm-hmm.
Actually, it reminds me of one of my favorite quotes. I think it's either Thoreau or Benjamin Franklin who said, how arrogant to sit down to write when you haven't stood up to live. It's one of my favorite quotes. I want to get into talking about publishing now. Robert, I want to start with you. This is one of my favorite questions. When do you know that a story is ready to be submitted?
I forget who I'm stealing this from, but it's just like when you know there's something wrong, but you can't say what it is anymore. I think that's a good principle to follow, because you're always going to feel like there's something not right about this. I think another just very simple thing to do, and I'm shocked when I meet people who don't do this, is read it out loud. I feel like it should sound like you can tell it, you know, at a you know, at a dinner or something. That's probably too ambitious for a short story, but you know what I mean? Like, you should at least strive for it though. Make sure it sounds right in your head. If the story does something weird, you should at least know why you did it that way. If your only answer to that question is to shrug, then maybe you do need to think about it a little more. And I've certainly been guilty of just being like, oh, the character does it because, I don't know, because he kind of needed to. You know, people have called me out for saying, like, the only reason your character suddenly had a change of heart was because if they didn't, like, the plot wouldn't have worked. And I'm like, you're right. You know, and that's when you have to go back. So, yeah, those are some basic ones to help. So.
And Danny, from the editorial perspective, are there any red flags you see often in stories that writers can avoid before submitting?
Yeah, definitely. Before I get onto that, I just want to piggyback off of something that Robert said. One of our authors, Hart Hansen, he's like he wrote Bones, the television show, and then he also wrote this badass book called The Driver. And he has a main character, and then like these two women are just like flocking all over him. And his editor was like, hey, why do these women want this man? And Hart was like, well, he's the main character. And he was like, and then I realized the book was on fire. So I think it's really good, like Robert said, just to be like, why are things happening? Is there a reason other than I need them to happen? And that's a really great, great checks and balance to see whether or not a story is ready to submit or whether a novel's ready to send to your editor or your agent, that kind of stuff. But in terms of red flags, there's a lot of things. Like bad grammar, like if someone submits something to me and it's riddled with typos, I know they didn't read it out loud. They didn't have a second reader. They didn't care enough about us as a publisher to respect that they should, you know, attempt to get it clean. A few typos is fine. Like, we all make mistakes. But yeah, something that looks really sloppy. A lot of people will like submit a blanket cover letter that clearly tells me they have no idea who we are. Like, we are a really weird journal. And like, if you aren't into the weird shit we're into, you should not send us stuff. Like that, like often there'll be pieces that are like clearly for the New Yorker, like angsty pieces where nothing happens. And they're addressed to like, dear Mr. Headland. And I'm like, okay, there's a lot of flags. So just like basic, do research into where you're submitting. I see this with my agents all the time too. People will query for representation and like not list any of the other books the agent carries, not talk about at all why you wanted that literary agent other than you are also Neil Gaiman's agent. So clearly you will love me. So that just a basic housekeeping. In terms of other red flags, really heavy exposition in the beginning, like very enormous paragraphs. Like they're just some visual stuff where I can almost tell what a story is going to be like before I start reading it. So certainly clean that kind of stuff up. Obviously actually listen to word count. I feel like authors just think like, I'm so good that they will respect this. And I'll be like, but I have a budget and a page count and I need you to give me the right word count. So there's a little stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I should say about word count. In my class, we do 15 pages and I had someone hand in a 30 page story and they said, yeah, but it's 15 sheets of paper. I'm just leaving that there.
So
the math checked out. So.
Danny, I want to follow up with something you said about, we don't talk about cover letters very often on the show. So I want to ask you, what do you look for in a cover letter? What should writers be including in that cover letter to get your attention?
That's a great question. I should say general submissions for fiction are read blind. So we don't read the cover letter until like a senior editor has decided to mentor the piece or it's pitched up to me. And the reason for that is we really respect slush. Like 30% of each of our issues comes from unrepresented writers. And we put debut authors and everything. So it's really important to us that we're not like, ooh, you'll sell a lot of copies because you're really shiny. That should never be a part of our reading experience. It should just be like, do I like this story? But for things like contests, like we let the cover letters be read by the judges. So Charlie Jane Anders was our last judge. So we really want to make sure in a cover letter, you're not being an asshole. That's like a big thing authors love doing, is being like, you will be a fool if you do not pick this story up. I don't know why someone thought that would be appropriate. Usually I like just to see a little bit of your bio, where else you've been published. I really love if you tell me you're a first time writer. If you're writing from a unique perspective, you are in a minority group or you have a really interesting life experience or say you're writing about space travel and you work at Space Force. I'm going to find that interesting. And then it's just really nice if someone writes a little paragraph about why you're submitting to us. Like, hey, I read the Monsters issue and I loved the piece by Benjamin Piercy and I really think this would be a good fit because I love your blah, 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 blah. We're all human. We're all really susceptible to flattery. So it really makes me happy when someone's like, cool, like there is a reason that you came to us with this piece. And yeah, just keep it really short. Usually no more than three paragraphs, about 300 words. That's all pretty good.
Is it safe to say they don't have to summarize what their story is about? Because I feel like a lot of people make that mistake.
Yeah, it just feels like my like second grade teacher is like, and then we're going to read this really great story about how family is important. You never need to summarize stories for us. Your story should speak for yourself. The cover letter is just to tell me who you are as a person. And that's always exciting for us as editors because we want to connect with you. But you never need to tell me anything about the story.
And Robert, at what point in writing a piece are you thinking about where to send it? Is that something that's always on your mind, or do you just write the story first and then think about it after?
I usually write the story first and think about it after. I think, you know, there are so many journals out there, and it is difficult to keep track of, you know, which ones might be into it. And I don't think I've ever written a story thinking, this is the perfect story for such and such literary journal. I don't think I would even recommend that. I just think that that might lead to some disappointment. Because look, in some cases, you don't know who's reading your story. It could be like a 21-year-old intern who has already read 50 stories that are virtually the same as yours. And I tell people, I don't say that as a knock on journals, but I do say that to my students just so that they don't feel terrible when a story gets turned down, even though they thought it was perfect for this. Because it just, you know, it's part of the process. So yeah, I've never done that yet, but it might happen. Might happen someday.
Danny, do you think there are writers out there who read Friction and think, I'm going to send a story directly here, and then they write the story from there? And can that work that way? Or do you recommend what Robert said, just write the story and then worry about it?
In general, I recommend what Robert said. I think, like we've talked about, so much of writing is really hard, as everyone here knows. And everything that's going around outside, like, oh God, is this too long for this journal? Is this not marketable? Is this going to appeal to male writers in North America? These are all thoughts that you have when you're like more ingrained in the industry, and they're really distracting and they're terrible. So all you really need to do is be like, is there enough coffee in my cup? Am I writing something that matters? And everything else should be blocked out. When I say that, we've published four people that have either come to me at conferences or were once students I lectured at or have just written in their cover letter, I wrote this story for you. I've been studying this book like a crazy person. I have sticky notes on my wall with all these diagrams about your editorial choices, and I have catered this. And I've been like, ooh, that looks scary. And I've read it, and I'm like, oh, actually, this is just great. So there have been people like that. And certainly a lot of my authors have been like, I will get this into the Paris Review and I will write 55 billion stories until the Paris Review takes me. And sometimes that really works, but generally try not to think about anything but writing because everything else is really distracting.
So Robert, then how do you know when a literary magazine's right for your piece? Once you've written the piece, it's ready to go. What do you do next? You start just reading them, or how do you know when a literary magazine is right for you?
That's difficult to say unless you're really reading a lot of them. And I admit that I'm not reading them as often as I should. And they will all of their submission guidelines will tell you, like, you should at least be a little bit familiar with what we're doing here. Look, I mean, I think it's pretty simple. If you've read a story in a journal that you liked and is in a similar genre to what you're doing, that I think is good enough. And I think sending, you know, if you include just a simple line in the cover letter that just says, look, I like what you guys do. There was a story I read 6 months ago from you guys that was just awesome. And it would be cool if I was, you know, if you said something like that, it's not automatically going to get you to the top of the pile, but it's a nice human to human interaction in what is otherwise, you know, a pretty cold interaction. You know, I often tell my students, like, look, the editor you're sending it to, they don't owe you anything. They don't owe you a critique of your story or recommendations where to send it to. You don't necessarily owe them anything other than just writing a good story and that's it. I mean, that's your relationship up until they actually contact you. which is both liberating and it might sound a little bleak, but I think it's mostly liberating and just keeps things professional. So yeah, I would just say, if you've read stuff you like, feel free to mention it in the cover letter, but I don't think you need to go much further than that. I mean, this diagram stuff with the you know, sticky notes and stuff sounds fascinating. Hey, if you're at that level, if you have that much time and you're that enthusiastic, go for it. But, you know.
So, Danny, we've talked about this a little bit, but I want to just hear a succinct, what is Friction looking for? If you had to break it down, you know, we all see on literary magazines, it'll say, be sure you know the magazine that you read it, but then we'll see what kind of stuff they like. So for Friction, what kind of stuff is that?
I wish I had a really succinct answer, and I will try to make it that way. But Friction really wants to put the story first. So we publish all genres. That includes literary fiction, creative nonfiction, poetry, hard sci-fi, horror. We put a comic in every single issue, which, if you're wondering, is fiscally very stupid. But comics is a really weird industry that doesn't have the same sort of, you publish in small journals, then you get a literary agent, then you get a book. There's no pipeline like that for comics. So we're fine hemorrhaging like $20,000 a year to just make sure three comic people get their career settled. But anyway, the point is, what I really look for are stories that take big chances. I really care about the prose style. I think that there's a sort of tendency in genre fiction to say, okay, the world building is more important than me really mastering my craft. And I don't need like loquacious, I don't need Dickens, but I need the story's voice to be really compelling. And I need it to have good change. Like, that's really, really what I look for. Every now and then I get lucky enough that I read a submission, and even with my cold, dark heart, like, it makes me tear up a bit. Ooh, I love that. So yeah, the point is, I know this is really unhelpful, but like, things that are really good, that take big chances, that aren't afraid to delve into things that might make us a wee bit uncomfortable, that's totally my jam.
So I want to talk a little bit about rejection, not long, but I do want to touch on rejection. Robert, all writers face rejection. How do you stay positive, and how do you continue moving forward when you're getting rejection, especially form rejections? What's your mindset there?
I mean, I've definitely become more zen about it as time has gone on. I mean, there was a time in grad school where I was pasting all of my rejection letters onto a wall. I've done that corny, cliched thing. And, you know, there was something like defiant about it, and some sort of like, you know, there was like a fatalistic determination to it, gallows humor to it. But honestly, as I learned more about how journals work, and today listening to Danny has been educational, and, you know, just understanding like the people who work on a lot of these journals are working very hard for not much power or glory or money to keep this art form, this amazing limitless art form alive. So you can be annoyed with them for not recognizing your genius, or you just use it as an impetus to keep getting better to the point where they won't be sending you form letters anymore. But, you know, just understand, like, there's a million things that go into a decision to include or reject a story. And those things don't always have to do with what the story's about. Maybe they already have a similar story. The journal's already full. They did something similar to it a while ago. Like, there's a bunch of things that might go into it that have nothing to do with how good or bad your story is. So just, you know, don't get too bogged down in it. Don't be, just use it as an impetus to keep getting better. All right. That's the best thing you can do for you.
Mm-hmm. Danny, what about you? Anything you wish you could tell all the writers that Friction has ever rejected, or just general thoughts on how people can handle rejection?
Yeah. I mean, I really like what Robert said in terms of there's always a billion reasons something could get rejected. Friction receives over 10,000 submissions a year, and we, not including solicitations from celebrities, and we publish from the slush like 30 or 40. So like that's a huge sort of differential. But one of the things that Friction does, because I've been in a writer's shoes, is every single rejection is not form. Like, we'll tell you what works, we'll tell you what doesn't, and we'll tell you if there was something weird that happened. Like, hey, we just published a story like this. Or weirdly, we only had men in this journal, and I noticed that you had a penis and we couldn't put another man in this journal. Because publishing like goes out of its way to obfuscate what's happening. And it's a disservice to everyone. It doesn't help a writer get better. It doesn't help me as a publisher. It doesn't help anyone. So like we work really hard just to say, hey, this is what's actually happening. So I'm really keen on that. In terms of what I tell my writers is just keep going. So like you finished a piece and you submitted it out, start writing another piece immediately. So you always have something in the cooker. Because the moment that you're just waiting for something, those rejections hurt so much more, especially for authors that are querying for agents. Like if anyone's gotten to that stage, querying for agents is one of the most painful experiences that most authors have. Some of us get really lucky and we get picked up on our first one and Neil Gaiman's agent is our agent. But usually it's like, oh, wow, this is waiting for 6 months for someone to tell me, oh, hey, my boss didn't read this, but I'm the secretary and I read it and we don't like it. So just always keep moving as much as possible. It'll keep you sane.
Thank you. Thank you. So we're going to jump over to audience Q&A now. I got a little bit carried away with the time, but we're going to fit as many questions from the audience here as we can. Let's start with this one. Danny, you talked a bit about cover letters. What if somebody doesn't have an education in creative writing? They don't have anywhere they've been published. What do you include in your bio if you don't have a background in publishing?
Well, first of all, that's fine. Like, I think since our philosophy is go out and live a bunch to write well, honestly, it doesn't matter to me as an editor what your background is. If you're starting out, just tell me that. Just be like, hey, I'm a brand new writer. Here's the kind of stuff I'm interested in. Like, I would love for you to look at my piece. That's great. Try not to make stuff up. That's always like a really good line. I see a lot of new writers being like, well, I spent a long time eating croissants in France and staring into the park, and I think I now understand da-da-da. That seems odd to me. I mean, you could try it. Sometimes we laugh about it. But usually just tell me you're new, and then we'll be like, okay. If anything, we're more often we'll work with brand new writers than more seasoned writers because we know they need someone to take a chance on them. So just tell me that.
Robert, let's get this question to you. The term speculative fiction, where does that fit into the genre sphere?
I mean, I have used the term speculative fiction just to refer to any kind of fiction that instills some sort of sense of wonder or awe, or that's exploring some, you know, some premise that may not exactly apply to the real world, but it is easy to imagine it in the real world. So I've used it very loosely. And in my class, you know, I tell people, look, we don't have to be doing Lord of the Rings here. As long as there's some element to it that is fanciful in some way, or maybe, you know, just comes from your imagination, then that's fine with me. And we'll put that under this gigantic umbrella of speculative fiction, which I think has been used mainly to combine science fiction and fantasy. I mean, saying science fiction and fantasy all the time just gets too much. And the abbreviation SFF doesn't sound right either. So I think that's another important reason why the term speculative fiction is useful. Mm-hmm.
So I want to start with Danny on this one, but I want to hear both of you on this question just because I want to hear your answers. Person asks, I am a new writer. Do I have any chance of getting published? Danny, what would you tell them?
Absolutely. Every new writer started at a new phase. Just put on all of your mental armor, get ready to probably get your ass handed to you in rejections, and be stubborn enough to keep going. Like, for me as a publisher and as an employer, I look for stubbornness before I look for talent. Talent can be developed. Stubbornness is something that you just have in your heart. So yeah, just keep going, keep working at it. Everyone starts somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Robert, what about you?
I would say just a few beginner tips is, you know, don't be afraid to show your work to some friends, but also like show it to people who might not necessarily be your friend, who's going to tell you the truth. I mean, to me, just having other people who I respected tell me what I was doing wrong went a long way, because the temptation among a lot of people is just to show it to their significant other or a relative. And they're like, wow, you wrote a lot of words. So, you know, being willing to have your ass handed to you, as Danny phrased it, which I think is the right way to phrase it, you know, having that humility, having that stubbornness, understanding that sitting around and lamenting about how you're not getting published is not going to get you any better, and is just, you know, it's a waste of time. So the better way to spend your time is just working on new projects. Ray Bradbury, his advice is, you know, don't necessarily start with a novel, because that you might just get discouraged. If you commit yourself to writing a new short story, maybe every week or every month for the next year, most of those stories will suck. A few of them might be good, but you will definitely be better. It's impossible to put that much work into it and not at least be noticeably better after a given period of time.
To piggyback off of what Robert said about having other people read your stuff, listen to other people. There's a really big tendency, because what we write is so intimate, if someone's like, hey, I didn't like this, to be like, you don't understand me. That's the stupidest thing I ever did as a writer. And I think it's the most helpful thing I learned about being an editor is seeing someone with so much potential who comes back at me with a lot of ego and a story will die because of it. Like, give it to people that you actually care about their opinions. And if they say something doesn't work, actually onboard that feedback instead of thinking that it's their fault.
Yeah. And embrace revision. Learn to love it. Don't just grudgingly do it. And don't fall into this trap of thinking that, like, you know, oh, well, Jack Kerouac put a giant roll of paper up against a typewriter and typed for 3 weeks, and that's how we got this amazing book. It's like, that is cool, but most of the work is going to be done during revision. And if you don't learn to love it, and if you don't learn to look at it the same level of inspiration that you do with just writing, just free writing, you're going to have a low ceiling. You have to learn to love revision and accept it.
Danny, next question for you. Do you recommend submitting during the early part of a reading period, or does it matter when people submit?
So for contests, it doesn't really matter for most places where you submit. Like, you will, usually a contest has a judge, and usually a celebrity judge if it's a larger journal. So a whole bunch of interns and junior editors and da-da-da-da-da will read it up to then, but at the end of the day, you need the whole pie to figure out which slices are going to go over. General submissions, I tend to say submit kind of as early as you can, because editors are humans, and they're usually humans like working other jobs. So that big crunch at the end of a deadline means they're like, okay, I used to read 10 stories a week. Now I have 50 stories and my boss is breathing down my throat, my neck, to make sure that I can turn them in. So sometimes they'll be a little bit more rushed and a little bit harsher. So I always try to get people to submit in the middle or the beginning. But honestly, if it's really good, people are going to find it really good. But if there's like a nice margin of error to not waiting till the last moment, which I know is not our kind. 90% of our submissions come in the last day of anything I've ever run in my entire career, because we all procrastinate.
Robert, next question for you. How can I build empathy for characters who begin with few redeeming qualities?
Maybe I think this could even go for a villain, like showing how desperately they want something and being very clear about what will happen if they don't get it. And being willing to show that, you know, if they don't get it, the consequences are quite dire. I think this is a mistake people make very often with villains. I mean, I think ideally you should be able to take your story and tip it over upside down so that if we're now looking at through the villain's eyes, it's still a full, complete story where the villain is going to, you know, they're going to have a goal, they're going to go for it. You know, they're gonna have obstacles in their way. Like they can be the protagonist of the story if you tilted it over. But I think what a lot of people do, especially if they were raised on bad 80s action movies, is like the bad guy is evil just because he is, and everything comes so easily to him. And maybe it's only in the last like 3 minutes of the story where he's finally like, oh no, you know. But I think showing how desperate your villain could be early on can go a long way. Or just seeing like their way of looking at the world. I mean, you know, Cormac McCarthy establishes this in No Country for Old Men. Technically not genre fiction, but like there's something weird and supernatural about the sugar character that, you know, he has his own weird philosophy of life. And it, once you grasp that, you're like, oh man. So that's, yeah, showing how desperate they are to get what they want. Same as you would with your protagonist. That helps a lot.
Danny, I want to sneak one more question in here. If a story gets rejected and is then significantly revised, would it get considered? Would it get consideration again?
Absolutely. Often my editors will ask, like, hey, if you want to take another revision of this, pass it on. But even if they don't, if you make significant revisions, absolutely send it back. And then usually just say that in your cover letter, like, hey, this was rejected 4 months ago, but I had a real long think about it, and I changed the stuff, and I'd really love you to take another look. I love that.
All right, so that's all the time we have for today. Thank you, Robert and Danny, for being here, especially with the holidays coming up. Everybody have a wonderful holiday. We're going to be back next week, Wednesday, same time. We're talking about satire and parody. Again, a reminder, any of the links or stories mentioned in this show, I will include links to those when I send out the email to everybody that registered for this. Lastly, if you have any questions about the show, I am josh@gothamwriters.com. Feel free to reach out. Again, Robert, Danny, thank you both so much.
Thank you. Nice meeting you.
And we will see you all next week. Have a great holiday.